We're back to the Neil Haley Show on the Caregiver Dave celebrity segment. And, you know, Dave, I wanted to kind of talk about, since we say Happy New Year to each other, Caregiver Dave, how are you? I've interviewed somebody from the White House in the Reagan administration already this week. So our theme is pretty interesting with our guest, and I can't wait to kind of delve into different things. But Dave, how are you, and Happy New Year?
I'm awesome. Thank you. How are you?
Hey, you know what? It's always great to chat with people, and it's a really, really interesting guest. So I'm excited to welcome to the program former White House correspondent Don Rehm. And Don, thanks for calling. I cannot wait to learn all the different things of how we can boost workplace productivity. Because Don, really quick before we even go into questions, I am kind of transitioning. I still own a tutoring and consulting company, but I am working for a company, and I'm seeing specifically enough what you're talking about. The hardest thing for organizations that grow larger, Don, in my opinion, and I'm sure you agree with me, is management. How do you kind of look at that, the whole company, and how you as manage them to reach their highest productivity, right?
Yeah, it is. It can be harder in larger organizations. One of the advantages of a smaller organization is that more employees have direct contact with the CEO and senior leaders. And that kind of contact is important and exciting and motivating. Often the bigger an organization gets, the quality of leadership can decline as you go down the leadership ranks into second and third tier managers. And that can be an issue for sure.
All right, Dave, I'm throwing you right to the talk and ask questions to Don. I'm sure you want to know about his White House days, don't you, Dave?
I do, Don. How long ago were you correspondent there? And the second part of that question is, which is a funny one, is what differences do you see if you were working today in the White House than when you were working there?
Well, I was there during the first Bush administration, during Desert Storm, so I'm dating myself a little bit, and it was quite different. It was more collegial then. That was back in the day, and I was a technical consultant on the House Science and Technology Committee in the House. And back in those days, you know, you talk about Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, they made deals. They got along. They liked each other. Things happened and got done for the sake of the country. But it's so politicized now, and each side seems to be taking positions just to take positions. I don't think it would be much fun to be there today, frankly.
And I think, Don, you arrived at the right time, because when you look at the Reagan administration and who I interviewed earlier this week, that was a pretty stressful time as well, even though Reagan was doing such great things because of our political climate, especially our foreign policy climate at that time. And when you were there, were you seeing the same kind of things? There were still stressors about certain foreign conflicts and stuff when you were a correspondent?
Well, yeah, certainly. And I still remember getting the call from the White House communication office to be ready to start covering Desert Storm. They don't give you details, but they tell you when you need to be ready. And of course, that's a little nerve wracking. But yeah, there was a lot of tension there. But it's you still seem to have more people on either side of the aisle that were willing to work together toward the country's good. Now people seem to have backed into their corners, and they're just defending ideologies instead of representing the country.
Well, that was groundbreaking, too, because in those days, CNN was fairly new, and that was the first time America actually witnessed a play-by-play war on foreign soil, right?
Yeah, it really was. But now, to change the topic, the war that I'm focused on now is the war for talent, the war for engagement, and how do we get, and there is a war for talent now with the lowest unemployment rate since the Vietnam War. Employees have more choice today than they've ever had before. And so for the first time in our history, managers at every level have to have the ability to create the conditions where employees look forward to coming to work. And that's not something managers had to do in the past.
And that's an interesting point that I think that things have changed. I remember as a school teacher, when I taught before I became an entrepreneur, I don't think they were looking at the environment of our teachers to see if we're happy to be there. So I think that's the next probably area that needs to improve in so many ways, but because there's so much competition for to hire people, Don, that's why they have to really engage, right? Because they have to make sure that they keep their employees and not spend so much time in training them, then they quit.
Yeah. I had a CEO of a construction company in Phoenix say, Don, the reason you and your company are in here today is because I'm building a structure on the south side of the street downtown. I've got a competitor building another building on the north side of the street downtown. I need to know how to keep my employees from walking across the street to my competitor for 25 cents an hour more, because they do. And so the only way to prevent that from happening is to create what we call emotional Velcro between the employee and the company. If there is no emotional Velcro between the employee and the company, they will walk for more money. And this is one of the big challenges also with millennials, anyone that's 34 or younger. The last time I looked at the Department of Labor statistics, the average tenure of a millennial was 2.5 years. So in many ways, they're already voting with their feet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'll give you a great example. You know, I have a mobile station, and back before 2000, mobile was a great company. They had a philosophy to keep their employees happy, even at the gas station level, because they were following the McDonald's model, you know, and there were a lot of criticism at that time where these people in their ivory palaces were making decisions based on the people in the field who had no clue what it was like to do what they do. And so they would empower the little guy to make important decisions. And that really gave them that feeling that, wow, I really am a part of the team. I'm part of the company. My opinion matters. And suggestion boxes, you know, make things more efficient, et cetera. Then when Exxon and Mobil merged, all that went out the window, because Exxon has a totally different management style. And a lot of things happened with morale going much lower, not only in the corporate settings, but in the gas stations as well.
Yeah, there's no question. So we measure engagement inside our client companies, and we know how engaged employees are under every manager in the organization. One of the things that increases engagement is empowerment, autonomy, which is really equivalent to the organization saying, we trust you. And that's a huge source of emotional Velcro, a sense of trust in their leaders. No question.
And so when you say the trust, are you happy, Don, the direction it's going? I'm sure it helps you because you knew how to deal with people, especially from your experience in the White House to later on in different things, and seeing how important happy people or become more productive, or they look at the person, not just the number. You must be excited about the possibilities with all these companies finally figuring out this is an important part of having a good, successful business, is to have good employee engagement, is to make sure that there is a good relationship going between manager and employee.
Absolutely. So the title of my book, the book published by Forbes, is called Thrive by Design: The Neuroscience That Drives High Performance Cultures. And this is exactly what we've done. We've learned more about the brain in the last 8 years than we have in the previous 1,000. And one of the things we now have a very clear idea on is what drives human behavior at the most elementary, fundamental level. And it's the same for everyone. Not only do we share 99.9% of our DNA with each other, we also share common origins of behavior. And it turns out in its simplest form that Homo sapiens are herd animals. And what that means is that we are designed neurologically to work best in groups. Human beings perform at their best when they do so with others. And all we are doing in our organization is showing companies how to create the conditions where human beings will thrive, not because of motivational campaigns and posters and cognitive instructions and motivation, but simply by creating the conditions where the brain will thrive automatically on its own because of the way we're hardwired at birth.
Yeah. So how are we doing? What's the report card on industry and our corporations? What percentage of companies would you say are doing it right, and what percentage have a lot to learn?
Well, yeah, very few are doing it well. I mean, when you just think of the number of companies in the U.S. economy, very small percentage, maybe 5 or 10%. Most companies are still using the old top-down hierarchical punitive management style. It worked in an era of labor abundance, but in an era of labor scarcity, you actually have to worry about how employees feel when they're at work. So it's different, and it's a relatively small percentage. According to Gallup, who does a lot of surveying in this area, they say about 70% of U.S. workers are disengaged when they go to work. What we're finding in our organizations, after just 2 or 3 years of working with us, they're in the 60% range of engagement. We're seeing 20, 30% improvement year over year for first-year clients. When you use science to do this, you get results. And here's the issue. There are more than 1,000 books in print today on leadership, and very few of them are based on science. And that's why after really 2.5 decades of being immersed in leadership books and literature, the number of employees who are engaged when they go to work, I don't think has moved a single percentage point. The current process, cognitive process, isn't enough. We need to use science and understand what are the conditions that science tells us where people will operate at closer to their fullest capacity. We now know what those conditions are, and that's what I write about in the book.
Let me go to a profession. I'm bringing up teaching because that's what the profession I was in. When putting performance assessment standards based on your performance as a teacher and getting rewards, people are seeing, even with that financial reward in teaching, it still does not mean that you're going to perform well as a teacher, that that's going to motivate teachers to do their very best and be the best that they can be. So that's an example of where I have seen specifically enough what people are motivated by. What do you feel people are motivated by?
Well, money is not a motivator, although a lot of people will tell you they're motivated by money. Money is a satisfier. It's not a motivator. And I get in audiences with managers when I'm talking to them, that they're all shaking their head like, no way. They're thinking, if I was paid more, I would do more. And then I ask the simple question. I say, thinking about your company, if you gave everyone in your organization a 20% raise tomorrow, would you see a 20% improvement in their engagement or productivity? And almost every head in the room, they're shaking their head no. And they're right, because the correlation between money, salary and benefits, and daily behavior is virtually zero. It's not what motivates daily behavior. Money is an extrinsic motivator. What drives the majority of our behavior during the day are intrinsic motivators. And that's what I talk about in the book. That's where you get the highest return on your investment. I'd love companies to pay their employees as much as they can, but there are too many managers who tell me directly, Don, there's nothing I can do to improve the engagement of my people until my company pays them more. And I know that's not true from our data. And let me give you a quick example. When we have a proprietary tool that we use to measure engagement, it's 28 questions, every employee in the company takes it. But then we separate the data by manager. So we have the same company, same culture, same salary and benefits package. Some work groups are 100% engaged. Some work groups are 100% disengaged. What's the only difference between those two work groups? And the answer is the manager. Oh. And so we know it's not about the money.
Is this a problem with larger corporations or smaller corporations? I mean, who's doing the best job? The Exxon Mobils out there, or the Walmarts, or just the mom and pops out there?
Well, even mom and pops can operate from a hierarchical, top-down, punitive environment. It's really the CEOs that want to create a legacy of a healthy, effective place to work. The part of the brain that is in charge, that has what neuroscientists call control precedence, is the limbic system. It's the part of the brain that's involved in fight, flight, or freeze and emotional processing. This part of the brain, what the research appears to indicate, that it responds to the most in terms of being productive and operating at full capacity, are two key words: consistency and predictability. Do we know what's going to happen next? and do we feel safe? And one of the ways we feel safe is when we know what's going to happen next and the environment we're in is predictable. Now, that includes predictably getting validation, recognition, constructive feedback. These are things that that pull the internal cords of intrinsic motivation. If I have a boss that sees me, values me as a human being, gives me recognition when I deserve it, that's incredibly motivating for the brain.
And that's so important. And then what, when you think in the teaching profession, this is Don, I think you need to go to every school district in the country and talk to the principals and talk to the superintendents and talk to all the people, because I've been in the culture of teaching, and the culture in teaching does not provide that for teachers. Teachers are basically managed like they're children, and they don't feel any autonomy. They don't feel welcome. They don't feel loved. And that's an area, it's great to see other work cultures like, let's say, Google or different places where they're giving that more employee engagement, giving more autonomy. Some people getting to work from home at times, but we're looking at professions like teaching or other certain professions that are very still backwards. Everyone needs to move to this model.
They do.
Let me add something to that before you answer that. We haven't talked about, you know, how an employee feels when he realizes that his supervisor is making 3, 4, 5 times the amount of money he's making, and yet there has to be some disconnect there, right? Administrators are making $200,000-$300,000 in the LA Unified School District, for example. Lucky if he can make $50,000 or $60,000. Isn't that demotivating right there?
Well, we know in the research, one of the things that motivates human behavior and creates a felt sense of safety is fairness and equity. And working in an environment that feels fair and equitable does increase engagement. So if you're working in an environment where you don't think you are treated fairly, and in this case, the metric is salary, that will have an impact on engagement. And it gets worse. It's magnified when those high-paid people in leadership positions aren't congruent with the core values of the organization, operate in a way where they feel disconnected from the other employees. They feel that they're better than others, and they treat them in what therapists would call a one-down position. So you have the disparity in the salary around a sense of equity, but then you have often the disconnect of those people with core mission and values, and it has a devastating impact on engagement.
And what do you think?
Good luck trying to get those executives to give up some of that money, because we know that doesn't happen very frequently. Just to make their employees happy, I got to take a cut or whatever.
Well, you know, it would be mitigated if there wasn't such a disparity for certain. It's a sense also, I said money isn't a motivator, but in many workplace cultures, they're so bereft of validation and recognition that for many employees, the last remaining metric that they have to know whether they are valued by the employer is what they're paid and what kind of a raise they get. So in many organizations, right, the value of the raise has been magnified because it essentially is a proxy for, do I matter to my employer? If we had more recognition and validation systems embedded in the organizations, the role of salary and benefits would be diminished. And let me give you an example of this. For the top performers, what we call the actively engaged employees, what some people might call their A players, they are much less concerned about money and income and what their raise is than the disengaged employees. The more disengaged the employee is, the more focused they are on what they're paid, because for them, many of them, most of them, the only reason they're coming to work every day is for the paycheck. So, of course, it looms large in terms of its importance.
And if you don't see an opportunity for growth, and that's probably also a situation, it's not always the salary, but it's the opportunity to advance with the company and see that you're a value to the company.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is especially true for millennials, 34 age and younger, and Gen Z, 22 years of age and younger. They expect their employer to invest in them, in their personal growth and professional development, even in areas that don't directly relate to the job they're doing. They simply expect their employer to be investing in them. And this is an area where many organizations could do more. And in our client organizations, when they do that, they see rich dividends and they start creating this emotional Velcro where the employee says, wow, this employer is investing in me. They're much less likely to jump ship for a few bucks an hour more if they really feel that they're valued in that way. And there are other things that are going on. I'll tell you some things we're doing at E3 Solutions, my company. We now have what's generally called unlimited PTO or personal time off. We don't limit the amount of vacation that people can take by how many years they've worked. They can take a vacation when they feel they need it. But at the same time, they have to make sure that their work will get done. And it's what's fascinating is this, of course, assumes you have people of integrity working for you. But it works really, really well. And when people feel we don't worry about burnout because if people feel they're just totally extended, they can just take the time they need and everyone else then fills in for them. They know it's going to be hard to get that somewhere else. And that becomes a part of the emotional Velcro of my team with our company.
Great.
Wow. That's amazing. So I assume reading your book is only the first step of a company or an executive deciding that he wants to make some changes. What do you do besides writing the book to get people engaged into this new philosophy?
Well, excuse me, we do a couple of things. First, you can't manage what you don't measure. So we have a proprietary tool, an online survey that every employee in the organization takes. And that way we can map engagement in the organization. Then generally the first thing we do is what we call an employee engagement boot camp for managers. And it's a day-long workshop that managers come to, and we talk about the science of engagement, the science of human behavior, and then how to use that in the workplace. Then they typically do another training within every, one or two quarters. We have workshops on positive leadership, accountability, recognition and feedback. We have about 8 different workshops that they can take. So generally, you want to be doing at least one or two of those a year. But the real fun comes for us is when they take their engagement survey the second year, the third year, the fourth, fifth, sixth year, and you see this trend line of engagement as it goes up. And all of our clients show improvement year over year. It's just it's a great thing to see that go up, and at the same time, they see their turnover decline, the accident rate declines, productivity goes up, profitability goes up, the accident rate declines. So it literally is a rising tide that lifts all boats. It's a wonderful thing to see. And once they start, they never stop. We've never had a client say, look, we don't want to do this anymore, because it just creates such amazing change within the culture.
It makes sense. You're definitely the expert when it comes to the sciences, for sure, Don. One question I wanted to bring up, and I think that, again, the way that we've seen the growth of entrepreneurship in the last 20 years, companies need to compete with that as well. They could go work for themselves. Benefits cannot just be the only reason why people are going to work each day, because they could see that they could pay for their benefits by making more money and have all the autonomy and free time they want and use their talents, especially millennials, then go to work for a company 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, or or 9 to 5 or whatever. Right.
Well, and some organizations are allowing people to act like entrepreneurs within the organization. They'll give them, 1 or 2 days a month to work on their own projects for something for the company. And if that project turns into a product that's sellable, they have a piece of that action. That's how Post-it notes, by the way, were discovered, by 3M giving employees time to do their own research on their own projects. And that's how that was developed. So how can we help our employees feel entrepreneurial? So, for example, in my organization, I give employees a chance, take this idea and nurture it and grow it into something that we can offer clients. And when they do that, they then run it. So we have, for example, an online platform called the ManagerResourceCenter.com. It's an online platform that has every resource a manager would need to create the conditions where people thrive. And we've got one of our employees that just loved that idea, took it, ran with it, and now it's one of the most popular items for our clients. So can you allow your own employees to be entrepreneurial and run their own product, if you will? It's not possible in every organization. In manufacturing, you can't necessarily do that. But when you can, do you allow it? That could be important.
That's a great idea. You have some fantastic ideas, Don. But the last question I'm going to ask you is our guest, my co-host, Caregiver Dave. Have you heard the word caregiver? He has a tremendous story himself, and he always likes to ask the last question for the show to kind of close it out in a way based on what he does and his mission and vision. Go ahead, Dave, and ask that question. Then we'll find out your information, Don, to find more info on you. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, well, I've been a caregiver 22 years, and fortunately, I'm an entrepreneur. But for those who are caregivers and are not fortunate to be their own boss, many of them get fired or find that they have to quit or because they're bringing their problems to work with them, and they're a full-time caregiver. You know, I think only Hawaii is the only state in the nation that actually gives caregivers respite, even if you're a full-time worker. How does this fit in with your model there? You know, it's vacation, it's sick time, it's caregiver time, you know, personal time off. How does that fit in?
Well, self-care is really important in the healthcare industry, and it's also important for managers. We need to take proper self-care. We learn things now. We now have a sense, for example, of sleep debt and not getting enough sleep. Well, it builds up. We need to take care of it. We need to take care of ourselves so that we can take care of others. And that needs to be allowed. That's, for example, why I have this unlimited PTO. If someone needs self-care, if they need to stop and recharge, of course I want them to do that. I don't want them at work if it's going to push them over sort of a metabolic cliff. I want them to be able to come to work and to bring everything they've got. So providing that and allowing for that would be very important. I'll tell you one other thing that some companies are doing, and I love the idea, they're offering sabbaticals. So an employee works for the company for 5-10 years, they get a sabbatical. They can take 3 or 4 weeks off to recharge and do something they want to do. Now, some companies would say that's ridiculous. I'm not going to pay someone a month for not working. But it's actually, it's a fantastic part of what could be a retention strategy. And in this labor market, organizations need to be focused on how to retain workers. And that would certainly be true in the caregiver world, too, I would think.
All right, so we can check out Dave's website, caregiverdave.com. And where, Don, can we purchase your book, learn more about you? Where's the best place we can go?
Well, you can go to Amazon.com, Books a Million. Any of the standard online sites will have the book. Again, it's Thrive by Design, the neuroscience that drives high-performance cultures. And if your listeners wanted to see a little snippet, they could go to YouTube.com and just type in Don Rehm, that's R-H-E-E-M, TED Talk, Don Rehm TED Talk. And they'll get a nice 14 and a half minutes of me in front of a live audience talking about these issues. It's a great way to refresh and to get back into it again. They could also go to donrehm.com and learn more about the book, donrehm.com, donrehm.com.
All right, Don, thanks for calling. Good connecting.
Thanks, I think Don.
That definitely could speak about what's happening to caregivers. So thanks, guys, for calling, and take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. You're listening to Neil Haley's show. We'll be back.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Total Celebrity Show. You can check me out on Twitter at Total Tutor and Total Radio Net and all the exciting places. And I'm excited to welcome the program. This is a very interesting story. Someone who's a professional athlete who decided to go another route and continue his career. So I'm excited to welcome the program, Philadelphia Eagle and America's Got Talent season 11 finalist, John Dorenbos. John, thanks for calling. How are you?
Hey, my man. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here and ready to rock and roll, man.
Hey, that's the important thing. It's the off season, right? And at this time during the off season, you're taking care of a lot of different things, aren't you? It's the kind of, especially once everything kind of winds down in the season, isn't that true?
Yeah, and you know what? Magic in football has always been a balance for me. In the off season, I've always gone around touring. And the truth be told, I actually thought I was going to get cut every year I played. So in the off season, I was going to go figure out what my life was going to be and you know, 14 years went by, and you know, when I had the chance to do this show and the opportunity came, I was like, man, this is a great segue. Who knows how long I'll play it, but just from a performing standpoint, it was about the exposure. It was about the team. It was about working with the producers and having all their knowledge to make my act better. And in every aspect possible, it was a dream come true. I loved working with them, and that show made me better as a performer. I'm forever thankful.
Wow. So very, very interesting. And so when did you start being a magician? When did you start practicing magic?
I was 12, 13 years old. When my dad murdered my mother, and my sister and I went through pretty intense therapy, and in that process, I saw a 16-year-old magician named Michael Gross, and changed my life forever. And got into it. He bought me my first book. It was JV Bubble Coin Magic, and I learned all the moves. And really, for me, and I didn't realize this till later in life, for me, it was an outlet. And when I was practicing shuffling cards or just working on magic, it was really the only time where I didn't think about anything else. I didn't think about the problems we were having. I didn't think about any of that. And sure enough, it was an outlet that I still have today, and it's been awesome.
Well, definitely awesome where you're able to go with America's Got Talent. So when you first auditioned, did you think you'd make it, first of all? And second of all, did you think you'd go all the way to the finals?
You know what? I had confidence in my ability. And I didn't know how it was going to go. My first goal was just to get a good reaction from the judges, and then not really knowing how it would work out with training camp and football, and just kind of play it by ear and see how it went. So I was happy to keep progressing. And I think really when I kind of figured out that my advantage wasn't going to be so much the magic, it wasn't going to be competing with the illusion guys and flying around stage. My advantage was going to be kind of the chops and the ability to communicate and interact with those judges. And when I figured that out, that's when I was like, okay, I think I have a shot here, because I have a little bit different tactic and a little bit different style than the other magicians that I'm going to capitalize on.
So how many other magicians were competing with you on the show?
There's quite a few. You know, Haro is a magician from Japan who does beautiful magic, very staged, very produced. So I knew that I wasn't going to be able to compete with that. The clairvoyants kind of have that old school 40s European reading the minds. Okay, well, that's their stick, so you don't need to compete with that. And then there was Blake Voigt and I forgot his last name, the Rubik's Cube Steven. He's a really cool kid. So there's quite a few magicians. And I said, you know what? Don't worry about what they're all doing. Just stick true to who you are and find material that complement you. And don't get lost in trying to compete with their styles, because that's when things go south. So I kind of didn't even worry about the competition and just kind of try to compete with myself.
How do you define your style as a magician? Do you have a specific style that compare? You talked about all those different styles of the other competitors.
Yeah. Magic to me when I was a kid was cool. That's all it was. It was cool. It was fun. And so I've never tried to be the kind of the goth Jesus character, if you will, the supernatural character. I've never tried to do that. When I do magic, I want people to leave and be like, holy cow, that was awesome. That was fun. It is what it is. And if I can do that, then that's my goal. And it's kind of funny, because it's the goal, I think, of every performer. And I think what I was most proud of wasn't so much the tricks that we picked, but, you know, my fiance and I, we were like, dude, we got to get a standing ovation every single time. If we don't, then that's awful, right? And that was our goal. And, you know, I remember when I got the gold buzzer, I followed Hara, and he's flying around stage, turned himself into a bird, and disappeared midair. I was like, what the heck just happened? That was unbelievable. Here I am standing there with a pad of paper, a pen, and a deck of cards going. And I looked at her, and I said, honey, I don't think I picked the right trick, because what just happened was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And she looked at me and she said, don't worry about it, just be you. And that's your strength. Don't worry about the magic. You've never cared about the trick. The trick's always been secondary. Go be you. And I was like, babe, I love you. And walked out there, and it all worked out. So I just want people to have fun. And that's my goal.
And what did you think of the judges, dealing with them on a regular basis to get all the way to the finals? Because, again, working with them in a way of respecting their advice and trying some of their advice the next time you performed was very helpful for you, right?
So I like this. The interactions with the judges is only basically what you get on stage at that moment. And they want the judges' reactions to be authentic. They don't want them to know what to expect. So you're really working with the producers backstage. And I got to work a lot with Meg, and she was amazing. And, it's taking their advice. You know, these are people that have been filming the show for 11 years. Other magicians have been there. They know what works, what doesn't work, and they understand magic and what has to happen theatrically. And the judges from the reactions, I was really stoked. I mean, I don't think I can complain with the reactions I got. They really never said, try this or try that. The reaction I wanted was that was fun. And those are the ones I got. So I was proud of that.
So what did your teammates of the Eagles feel about you competing in this and then being involved in the competition and going as far as you did?
Dude, they were super supportive. The entire organization was. And, you know, it was really cool. Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman, Coach Peterson, and the entire organization basically came to me and said, hey, we got to allow you to do this. You've been here a long time. You've been doing magic a long time. It's part of who you are. How can we support you? How can we make this happen? And I would say, I mean, a lot of people didn't know this, and the team didn't at the time, but there were weeks where I was doing 5 or 6 round trips in a week.
Oh,
and I would, right after practice and meetings, I'd get on a flight just to go to L.A. for 2 hours and do some B-roll in an interview, and then I'd hop a red-eye, and I'd land at 7:30 in the morning, and I'd go to the 8:15 meeting. And we just did whatever it took. And at the same time, you know, it was exciting for Annalise and I, and kind of to juggle that schedule and to make it all happen. And we call it champagne problems because there's times where we might be a little stressed, and we'd look at each other and be like, really? Like, we're competing to make a team in the NFL, and we're competing on one of the number one shows in the history of television. Like, these are champagne problems. Let's just make it work.
and that's true. And just make it work. And now, how does the media feel in Philadelphia? Because, again, you're one of those players that probably they want to talk to all the time. Have you always been media friendly, would you say, John, in your career?
Yeah, you know, and I have. And I have maybe for different reasons than some. You know, when I was a kid, I was a huge Seattle Mariners fan. And, you know, Griffey and JP and Erica Martinez, all these guys were super cool. And I had minimal interaction with them. So when I made the NFL, I never thought I'd make it, to tell you that. Never thought I'd play 14 years, make a couple Pro Bowls, never in a million years. And so I've been a fan my whole career. And for me, the NFL has just been something that I view as a great story for my grandkids. And I think if we don't become what we do, we enjoy what we do. You know, America's Got Talent. It's same thing. It's just a great story for me to tell my grandkids one day.
Yeah, a book and to write, right, John?
Just, yeah. What's that?
A book to write at the end of your career. Do you think you're going to go into show biz after you retire from football?
Yeah, so I've had a lot of opportunities. And you know, even before the show, there were some shows that I kind of was in the works for and just scheduling didn't work out. But, you know, obviously, you know, for me, it was, the, you know, NBC vouches for you. NBC gives you a shot. America's Got Talent gives you a shot. They vouch
right, exactly.
for you. And as soon as that happens, it's a lot easier for other people to make decisions. Power television, right?
Exactly.
And now all of a sudden to get hired for gigs and speaking gigs, well, the buyers are like, look, NBC vouch for them. We're good. You know, and it kind of covers everybody's tail. So it was a win-win, man.
And the last question, again, for people that want to audition, especially a couple weeks ago, there were some big auditions in this. What advice would you offer them, especially when they're saying, I don't know if I have the talent, and you know it's coming to the specific city. What advice would you offer them?
You know what? This is what I would tell them. Don't hold back. You got to bring your A game every week. So don't say, I'm going to save this for the next round. Do it, and then you better figure out how to top yourself going to the next round. And, you know, right now I think there's 2 cities left. You know, Los Angeles is February 10th. Memphis is February 3rd. But for everybody out there, do it. It's life-changing. And don't think of it so much as I want to win this show. Think of it as, if I'm serious about being a performer, this is going to make me better. I'm going to get advice that I might not get somewhere else. I'm going to get people telling me what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, what I need to work on. If you can't make those auditions, go to agtauditions.com. I believe the deadline is around March 4th. But, hey, the sooner you get it in, the better. It changed my life, and I'm super glad I did it. Give it your all. Be true to who you are as a performer, and you're going to rock it.
And best place you can find information on you. You have a Twitter, different things like that, that people can check you out and follow you?
Yeah. You can go to johndornboss.com. You can all my stuff is the same. So Instagram is at John Dornboss, Facebook at John Dornboss, Twitter at John Dornboss, JONDORENBOS, no H in John. And, you know, if you email the website, that goes to my guy that posts it, but we try and get back to all the fan emails and requests. So we do the best we can. And I appreciate everything.
Well, John, thanks for taking the time. Best of luck and good luck on next season and also your career as a magician and an entertainer. Okay.
Thanks, man.
All right. Take care, man.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
See ya. Thanks. Okay. Bye. You're listening to the Total Celebrity Show. We'll be back in just a moment.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And when I think about this NFL running back, I think of one of the biggest backs ever. I mean, watching this guy run over people was amazing. Reminds me of the days of Earl Campbell or even later Jerome Bettis. But the big back was definitely, but his athleticism was fantastic. So I'm excited to welcome the program. Kansas City Chief Hall of Famer, California Sports Hall of Famer, Christian Okoye from the Kansas City Chiefs, the Nigerian Nightmare. Christian, thanks for calling, and how are you?
I'm great, man. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Christian. And when you look back, I know growing up in Nigeria, you never knew you were going to be a professional football player, did you?
No, we don't have football in Nigeria, so I didn't even know what it was before I came out to America.
And were you when you first learned about this sport? I know that you were an athlete, correct, before that in Nigeria, but when people kind of say, hey, you should try to play professional football, did you kind of say, well, what is this, and asking tons of questions once you got to the States?
Well, I was in track and field, and I played soccer growing up. When I came over to the United States, I came over to Azusa Pacific as a track and field guy. I was throwing discus, shot put, and the hammer throw. And when the Olympics came around in 1984, because I had been preparing myself to participate in the Olympics, but when the Olympics came around and then Nigeria didn't take me, I decided that I got to play something else, and soccer was a sport that I loved. But at this point, I was much bigger than the days of my soccer love. So I decided I'm going to try football, which friends have been trying to push me to, you know, get into and try it out. So in 1984 is when I started playing football.
Wow. And so did you play college football as well, Christian? Or did you go?
Yes. Yeah. Huh. Yes, I played college football at Azusa Pacific. Started my junior year in college.
Oh, wow. So all these other people, once you get to the NFL, have had so many years in the sport, and you're just a newbie in this. Some of them have played since Pop Warner. So what did they think of that? I'm sure there's a lot of a learning curve for learning the playbook and understanding the game completely.
Yeah, it was quite different for me, you know, knowing that everybody that I played the game with, they all have been playing football from when they were 4 or 5 years old, and they've been around the game, so it's part of their lives. But I started playing football at the age of 23 years old. And it was quite new to me, and, you know, I didn't know what to make of it, but because my friends encouraged me to stick with it, didn't like it when I started, not at all. But friends encouraged me to stick with it, and I think one of the reasons why I didn't like it is because I picked one of the most difficult positions, which is a running back position. I said difficult because as a beginner, as somebody who never played the game, you don't want to jump into a running back position because running back position is a very demanding position physically. And but that's what I liked, and I jumped into it, and it was quite difficult for me. But still, friends encouraged me to stick with it, which I did.
And did you, especially coming from a small school, were you looking at any other running backs that were the size that you were to kind of emulate or look at and how they ran the football that coaches talked to you about and stuff, especially being such a big back with such athleticism?
Well, I when I first started, I didn't know to look at anybody, but it was suggested to me to watch Jim Brown and, you know, some of the other running backs. And, of course, at the time, Marcus Allen was playing for the Raiders, and Eric Dickerson was out here in L.A. playing for the Rams. So I would watch them play. And And they both became friends of mine, of course, when I started playing the NFL. But those are two guys that I watched the most. But then I got into watching Walter Payton, watched a lot of films of Jim Taylor, the former Green Bay running back, and some of the other guys. So I was just learning as much as I can just so I can hang on to the game, which I did.
Well, you definitely did. And then I tell you, Chiefs Nation really loved you, didn't they? Especially the years when you came out and they're like, wow, look at this. This is a different type of back. You're running over people. And you really were personified Kansas City Chief football, in my opinion, for sure, with just the hard work ethic and just run over type of mentality of Kansas City, I think.
Well, you know, I love Kansas City. Kansas City, I think, in my mind, I believe Kansas City has the best fans in the world. They love their Chiefs, and, you know, I love playing in Kansas City. Arrowhead Stadium is just a magical place. If you go there to watch a football game, I tell you, you'll be welcomed by the fans, and you see the passion they have over there for the Chiefs. And it's just incredible. And the Hunt family, I can tell you firsthand, they have made football very enjoyable in Kansas City, and we love it there.
Well, and definitely, and I guess especially when you look at being part of the Hall of Fame and to look at the tradition of the Chiefs and to be the all-time leading rusher when you retired is a tremendous feat for you, for sure, and that people just, when we mention this name in Chiefs folklore, people just absolutely flock to that player and that memories of you when you played for the Chiefs.
Well, I think, of course, when you play the type of, you know, football that we played when I was there with Marty Schottenheimer, who loved running the ball, smash my type football. I think people get to like that type of football. That's what we got into, and they loved it. When you run the ball a lot like we did, you control the clock, which we did, and it gives your defense a break some, so that when they get in there, they'll feel fresh to play well as well. So on both sides, we were very excited. And we made watching football in Kansas City very, very excited. So that's one of the contributions that we brought to Kansas City.
You definitely did. And the reason I was a big fan of yours growing up is because of Marty Schottenheimer being a Pitt guy. University of Pittsburgh, my mom went to school with Marty Schottenheimer. Never met him, but was there when Marty was at the University of Pittsburgh. So that's how I was such a huge fan of yours. Even being in Pittsburgh, being a Christian Okoye fan. Let's kind of go life after football. Now, a lot of things you have going on for yourself. Tell us specifically how hard that transition was, even such a short career, going into life after football.
Well, right now I have my foundation, which is now going on 26 years, the Christian Okoye Foundation, which is still going on. And 10 years ago, I founded the California Sports Hall of Fame, which every year we induct individuals into the California Sports Hall of Fame. And that is actually one of my bread and butters here. I love working the California Sports Hall of Fame and putting it together. One of those things that I'm now almost doing full time, actually. I sold my company about 4 years ago. I used to own a protein powder company, but I sold it. Mm-hmm. I'm now concentrated on these two organizations, and I love it.
Well, it seems like you definitely do. And tell me some of the people you've inducted in the California Sports Hall of Fame once you founded it. Name some other athletes.
Oh, gosh. You know, the likes of Joe Montana, Bo Jackson, Warren Moon. We inducted Warren Moon this year. Mike Garrett, Jamal Wilkes, former Laker, Lisa Fernandez, softball player. Danny Little Red Lopez, a boxer,
okay,
who was very, very popular here in California at the world champion. So we've inducted Magic Johnson, Reggie Jackson, Tommy Lasorda, John Wooden, Bill Walsh. I can go on and on and on.
Oh my.
So we've,
wow.
Right now, I think we've had about 76 inductees, I believe, in the California Sports Hall of Fame in the 10 years.
And it's amazing. So before that, there wasn't a California Sports Hall of Fame, Christian, if you found it?
No. No, there was no California Sports Hall of Fame. So, yeah.
Shocking when you think of a big state like that, for sure.
Yeah, well, in California, you have a regional Sports Hall of Fame. They have city Sports Hall of Fames and some county Sports Hall of Fame, you know, in different areas. I think they have like Bay Area, Riverside, Orange County, San Diego, you know. When I came back and did my research to see if there was a California Sports Hall of Fame, the state Sports Hall of Fame, there was none. So I decided to start one, and I made sure that I got every top sports personality in California to support. And one of the a few of the first ones that I contacted that threw in their support at the time is late Bill Walsh. He was the first one that threw in his support. John Wooden, of course, and Tommy Lasorda. Those three individuals were the first ones to jump in and support. So, with their support, we were surging ahead.
And it sounds like it, Christian. And what you're able to do is basically reaching out to these amazing athletes. You definitely seem like a great leader to be able to found this and to have such great athletes inducted in the California Sports Hall of Fame. And it must be a pleasure to be involved in this.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm just tickled to death. And like I said, it was a lot of fun to work it.
And so you have the foundation. That's fantastic. Where's the best place we can find information on, Christian, and learn more about you? Is it the best place to go ahead to, like, the California Sports Hall of Fame website, or is there a place we can
The two websites, californiasportshalloffame.org, or you can go to christianokoye.com. And, of course, my Twitter handle is at christianokoye.
Well, Christian, I'm glad we were able to take the chance to talk to you. Another one of the amazing running backs I've interviewed, for sure, but one of my favorites because of Marty Schottenheimer. You never would have thought that's the reason I was such a huge fan of yours, but being in Pittsburgh, I just was amazed by your play. And one of my colleagues that I used to work with is so excited I finally got the chance to interview you a couple years ago. Was to get you on, and I'm glad I was able to get you on now. So thanks again for calling, Christian, and best of luck to you.
All right, thank you. Good luck.
All right, take care. Thanks again. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Pros in the know start with Lowe's, because Lowe's makes it easy to save big on building materials to finish any job. Need to stock up on water heaters? Save 5% on select A.O. Smith water heaters when you buy three or more of the same model. Plus, save 5% on eligible purchases every day when you use your Lowe's business credit account. So, pro, now that you know, start with Lowe's. While supplies last, credit offer subject to credit approval. Can't be combined with other credit offers. Exclusions apply. U.S. only.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.